This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 20, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Indonesia removes thousands of troops from Aceh today. Calls on Capitol Hill demanding relief for Hurricane Katrina victims, regardless of their immigration status. And as Afghans wait for results from their general election, we'll hear from two candidates critical of the U.S. military presence. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The British government defended its decision to storm an Iraqi jail to free two soldiers detained by police in the southern town of Basra. Helen Kelly reports from London.
The two British soldiers, dressed in civilian clothing, had been arrested and taken to the prison after exchanging fire with Iraqi police at a checkpoint earlier in the day. It is thought the soldiers were then handed over to a militia group and moved to another location. Defence Secretary John Reid claimed the jail was targeted only after orders to release the British soldiers, given by local judges and the Iraqi Minister of the Interior, had been ignored. He said six military personnel had been sent to the prison to negotiate the release of the men. However, violence erupted outside the prison as a crowd of Iraqi demonstrators pelted the British armoured vehicles with stones and petrol bombs. It was then, the British Army claim, that an exterior wall was crushed by their troops. At the same time, a separate rescue operation was staged to remove the two British soldiers from the residence where they were being held. A spokesman for Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari condemned the rescue, saying it was a very unfortunate development. Helen Kelly, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
15 people pled guilty to multiple charges for participating in a violent uprising in the Uzbekistan town of Andijan in May of this year. This is the first of many trials for dozens of people accused of contributing to a revolt that began because 20 Muslim men were on trial for religious extremism. The rare uprising drew thousands of protesters and ended with an unknown number of people killed on May 13, 2005. The Uzbek government calls the alleged perpetrators Islamic extremists, but human rights groups denounce the trials as a government cover-up and another attempt of suppression. Rachel Denber is deputy director of the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch.
For the past few months, we know that the government has been engaged in this sort of exercise to create a whole separate other record of what happened on May 13th. And at the same time, the government has also unleashed a crackdown on civil society, on human rights defenders, on journalists, on political activists.
Human Rights Watch compiled their own testimonies of the events from that day. Arrest warrants have been requested for 12 former high-ranking Mexican officials with alleged ties to one of the country's most notorious massacres. One of those warrants is for former President Luis Echeverria. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca.
Despite the uncertain death toll, it is widely accepted that at least 300 people were killed when snipers and troops opened fire on a student rally 2 weeks before Mexico hosted the 1968 Olympics. Although survivors of the massacre point to army participation, Special Prosecutor Ignacio Carrillo has minimized the role of the armed forces, saying that both the military and the civilian population were victims of a trap. Carrillo cited investigations carried out by the military that indicate at least 360 snipers were strategically positioned around the site of the demonstration. Luis Echeverria, who was Secretary of the Interior at the time of the massacre, recently escaped prosecution for a 1971 student massacre when a lower court ruled against charging the ex-president with genocide. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
President Bush nominated Fran Townsend, his Homeland Security advisor, to lead an internal inquiry into the government's handling of Hurricane Katrina. Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, directed each federal agency to designate one person to work with Townsend in the investigation. Congress is creating a separate bipartisan commission to look into Katrina response. Many Republicans and President Bush oppose an independent commission to conduct the investigation. Tens of thousands of people across Asia are falling ill to dengue fever, a deadly mosquito-borne disease. It's prompting governments to issue serious warnings, although the cases continue to rise. Girly Linao in Manila reports.
Philippine health officials first raised the alarm on dengue fever in June following a spike in cases. By August, the country declared a nationwide alert as cases continued to rise. Local governments and communities were told to organize information campaigns about the deadly disease and hold cleanup drives to get rid of breeding grounds for mosquitoes. Despite the alert, more people are getting ill and dying from the disease that has no known cure or vaccine. According to the health department, almost 19,000 people have so far been infected since January. The figure is 26% up over the same period last year. 259 have died, up from 144 recorded last year. The World Health Organization said Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, and Singapore have also recorded large number of dengue cases this year. It was not clear what was causing the latest increase in cases. Authorities are baffled by the rise in Singapore, where more than 10,000 have so far been infected, 8 of them fatally. Hospitals have also been told to ensure that they have enough blood supplies for transfusions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linaw in Manila.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell, WPFW in Washington, D.C.
In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, thousands of undocumented immigrants affected by the devastation could face deportation if they seek federal disaster relief aid. A coalition of Latino organizations, along with 18 senators, is pressing President Bush to decree humanitarian protective status to all Hurricane Katrina survivors, regardless of immigration status. Selena Musuta reports from Capitol Hill.
Member organizations of the National Alliance of Latin American and Caribbean Communities lobbied on Capitol Hill for a presidential order that would protect undocumented immigrants who are seeking Hurricane Katrina governmental aid from deportation. Thousands affected by Hurricane Katrina lost all of their documents. This is the case for many documented immigrants, says Abel Munez of Centro Romero, a social service organization based in Chicago. Munez says that documented and undocumented immigrants are afraid to apply for government relief.
There are a lot of families that have mixed immigrant statuses, meaning that their children might be American citizens, so they are have access, but the parents might not be, or maybe other extended family members, so they might be afraid.
The bill that would overhaul the immigration system, sponsored by Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, a Democrat, and Arizona Senator John McCain, a Republican.
We know when they become a disaster like the hurricanes, in other part of the world, United States gives a lot of money, and they don't ask to what person they are going to give that money.
That was Gloria Sacedo of Jornada Mexicana, a Los Angeles-based organization that works on immigrant advocacy and defense. Sacedo believes that the inadequate Hurricane Katrina response to immigrants represents a greater failure in the immigration system, a system that often divides families and may further divide immigrant families in the Gulf Coast area.
We need to speak very loud to the Congress and to the President. We here in the United States to the separation of the families. We had mothers who are wife of American citizen, and they have children here. They are deported in Mexico or in Guatemala or in El Salvador because they don't have a good protection for immigration laws.
The Department of Homeland Security has encouraged all Hurricane Katrina survivors, including undocumented immigrants, to seek help, but has recently announced that undocumented immigrants seeking Hurricane Katrina federal assistance could face deportation. Selena Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
A nuclear crisis began in October 2002 when North Korea quit the Non-Proliferation Treaty and expelled international inspectors. That crisis appears to have gone through a breakthrough yesterday with the signature of a joint statement signed by the six parties participating in non-proliferation talks. But just one day later, everything appears to once again be compromised. Severine Bardon reports from Beijing.
The joint statement released yesterday in Beijing and signed by China, North Korea, South Korea, the United States, Japan, and Russia appeared as a major breakthrough after 3 years and four painful sessions of negotiations. Chinese analysts such as Lin Junqiu, head of research center on the Korean Peninsula, even welcomed the agreement seen as mutually beneficial for all parties involved.
This joint statement has been labeled joint because every party, all the six countries, agreed. Furthermore, during the negotiations, heads of delegations reported to their government to explain the process and get their agreement. So we can't say that this joint statement is in the interest of one country or against the interests of another one. It is a situation where everybody is a winner.
But the euphoria has come to an abrupt end today after North Korea's foreign ministry declared that the United States, quote, should not even dream of the issue of North Korea's dismantlement of its nuclear deterrent before providing light water reactor, a declaration dubbed unacceptable by Japan and totally opposed to the United States' conception of the agreement. Christopher Hill, head of the American delegation in Beijing, underlined after the signing yesterday that the reactor would be provided after the nuclear weapons are abandoned. The problem is that the time frame of the agreement's implementation has been left out of the joint statement and could be the core of future tensions, as explains Jin Linbo from China's Institute of International Studies, a think tank linked to China's foreign ministry.
I think this joint statement is a declaration of principles. It provides a frame. But there are still many concrete measures, many details that have not been solved. So when we talk about a breakthrough, I think it is because we have set up a framework to solve the nuclear problem in the Korean Peninsula. But it's not a breakthrough that means we have solved the problem.
This new and unexpected setback in the six-party talks might compromise the international economic help that should be provided within the frame of the joint statement, an aid much needed by North Korea, as underlines Gerald Bork, World Food Programme spokesman for its North Korea operations.
The sorts of assistance that are being talked about, were being talked about in the context of the six-party talks, very, very essential, very vital, much needed. On the electricity side, for example, the South Koreans have been talking about very major investments that would largely meet the country's requirements for electricity. So that's much more than a drop in the ocean, if it happens.
The only time commitment stipulated by the joint statement is a fifth round of six-party talks scheduled for November. Many issues will then have to be considered and might arouse yet another period of tension on the Korean Peninsula. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Beijing.
Around 2,600 Indonesian army troops are withdrawing from Aceh today after the Aceh Monitoring Mission, or AMM, succeeded in destroying about 800 guns handed over by the Free Aceh Movement, or GOM, last week. This is the first step in disarmament and military withdrawal as per the Helsinki Peace Agreement, signed August 15. Both the disarmament and the troop withdrawal will continue through December. From Jakarta, FSRN's Maggie Margiono has more.
Indonesian military officers, together with the Aceh Monitoring Mission, or AMM, and the Free Aceh Movement, or GOM, have destroyed guns collected by the GOM in three regions. This is just the beginning of the implementation of the peace deal reached in Helsinki last month. However, Indonesian military officer Major General Supriyadan expressed dissatisfaction with the disarmament so far because he says all of the guns collected by the GOM don't work. He says he hopes the GOM will collect the rest of their guns.
By December of this year, no matter how many guns have been destroyed, the GOM will no longer be armed. Since GOM members are no longer supposed to carry arms, anybody who does carry a gun will be in violation of the agreement and the law.
Spokesperson for Aceh Working Groups, Ato Syamsuddin Ishak, says that GOM has shown their goodwill by handing over their guns. But according to Ato, AMM has not yet made any detailed plan to withdraw the Indonesian army from Aceh.
Is GOM going to be granted a chance to register? Whether Indonesia's military withdraws from Aceh, like the Indonesian army is granted the opportunity to verify that GOM's guns are pulled? Will the Aceh Monitoring Mission watch over the Indonesian army that has withdrawn to the border of Aceh, equal to what the Aceh Monitoring Mission has done in destroying GOM's guns?
Aside from the surprising progress in implementing the Helsinki Peace Agreement, a new threat to the peace process is now emerging. Thousands of unidentified armed militias have appeared in some regions. They intimidate civilians and fire their guns into the air. Again, Ato Syamsuddin Ishak of the Aceh Working Group.
We hope that members of the Aceh Monitoring Mission do not just keep their eyes on the technical aspects of destroying GAM's guns. Moreover, the monitoring mission must identify who these illegal groups are. They have to facilitate Indonesia and GAM in identifying them.
Otto Syamsuddin adds that unidentified militias may break the peace process in Aceh. He says that Indonesia's army had previously set up militias when martial law was declared in 2002. At the same time, the commander of Indonesian military operations in Aceh says that he had dissolved the militias when martial law ended in 2004. Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, I'm Monica Lopez for Free Speech Radio News.
Results from Afghanistan's first general election in over 30 years will have to wait until donkeys bring the final ballot boxes down from the mountains, not expected before mid-October. Notorious warlords, hardline Muslims, and women's rights campaigners all appeared on the ballot paper, as well as a number of secular candidates critical of the U.S.-led military presence in the country and of President Hamid Karzai. Tony Cross talked to two of those candidates and files this report from Kabul.
Loudspeakers in Kabul's Shoinor Park broadcast horribly distorted recordings of Bashar Dost, as they have done for the several months since he resigned as Minister of Planning. Even before he declared himself a candidate in the general election, Dost was camped out in a tent in the park. From there, he criticized President Hamid Karzai and the international presence in the country, the International Security Force, foreign diplomats, and the non-governmental organizations whose offices can be found all over the major cities. Dost left the government after drawing up a list of hundreds of NGOs he claimed had huge budgets, but gave virtually nothing to the Afghan people. He also believes that notorious warlords will sit in the next parliament, and that what he calls Western lords, returned from foreign exile, have moved into politics for personal gain.
The system decide together in a restaurant, in a private house, in nightclub in Afghanistan. There is no transparency, and there is a lot of corruption between the member of the system, Afghan former cabinet, Afghan actual cabinet, NGO staff, national or international, and United Nations organization staff in Afghanistan, and also the big embassy staff in Afghanistan. They are all members of the system.
Dost believes this mafia is also complicit in the drugs trade. Since the US-led invasion, Afghanistan has returned to the top of the world league of opium poppy growers, providing the base from which most of the heroin sold in Europe and much of Asia is made. He says that only 1% of the profits go to Afghan farmers, and that local and international officials are involved in the trade.
It is also possible that Afghan parliamentary become a narco-traffic parliamentary. The Afghan Minister of Interior, about 3 months ago, he said the very higher authorities in Afghanistan involve in traffic of drug. And our Minister of Interior refused to give the name of this higher Afghan authorities. It is very strange because the job of Minister of Interior is to arrest this kind of person. 3 weeks ago, Mr. Karzai said 6 governors didn't cooperate with us against the traffic of drug.
Across town in the Afghan National Congress office, Dastgir Hujabr says the movement could work with Dost in the new parliament. The party's leader, Abdel Latif Pedram, came fifth in last year's presidential election, but hasn't stood this time. 19 other members have, and Hujabr is one of them. He says it's hard to fight for democracy in Afghanistan, where fundamentalists exploit people's religious feelings, and he lashes the US, whose troops he accuses of killing Afghans in custody, and treating the country's traditions with contempt.
We want assistance and cooperation of all international countries, including U.S. America. But we need their cooperation. But what we want from them that they should do their actions, their activities, according to the right, according to the rule, and according to the fair right chart If they keep doing like this, if they don't pay attention to the rule, maybe this community will move toward fighting, will move toward wars like the past. Maybe again the war will start in this country.
Hujab says the turnout in Sondi's election was about 35% lower than officially claimed, and he says that people are tired of Karzai's broken promises. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Kabul.
Disability activists from around the country have converged in Washington, D.C. this week for several days of lobbying and direct action. Americans Disabled for Attendant Programs Today, or ADAPT, are drawing attention to the struggle for independence from nursing homes. Brendan Costello was in Washington and files this report.
ADAPT, Americans Disabled for Attendant Programs Today, brought their confrontational style to Washington, D.C., putting pressure on Congress and federal agencies to recognize the rights and needs of people with disabilities. ADAPT voiced their demand for passage of legislation enabling people with disabilities and others to leave institutional environments and long-term managed care facilities. The proposed pieces of legislation, MECASA, Medicaid Community Attendant Services and Support Act, and S-528 and H.R. 3063, the Money Follows the Person Act of 2005, both allow federal and state monies to be used for services in an individual's residence of their choosing, rather than forcing them to stay in the state-run or state-approved long-term care facilities. Activists charge that being forced to live in these facilities is tantamount to incarceration. ADAPT's action started on Sunday with a five-mile march past the Capitol and the White House, all the way to the gates of Senator Bill Frist's home in D.C., where the boisterous crowd called attention to proposed Medicaid and Medicare cuts that ADAPT activists say would be disastrous for people with disabilities. Monday's activity began with a press conference at FEMA headquarters. Organizers talked about the aftermath of Katrina's effects on people with disabilities, and moving testimony was heard from several independent living center directors who are based in the affected area. Bob Liston, ADAPT member from Montana, tied the Katrina relief effort to the group's overall agenda.
Unfortunately, we've seen a number of nursing homes where people with disabilities, people who are older, have died because of Katrina, that were not able to get the services and supports that they need. I think that's one example of the institutional bias in long-term care not working. That's a very blatant way that it's not working.
After the press conference, the group split up and proceeded to occupy the offices of six congresspeople, Bill Frist, Harry Reid, and Charles Grassley in the Senate, and Dennis Hastert, Nancy Pelosi, and Texas Republican Joe Barton in the House. 104 people were arrested and were held until the middle of the night. Some were not released until 7 o'clock this morning. Today's activity included disrupting a Health and Human Services public hearing and more civil disobedience designed to draw attention to the importance of housing policy as it pertains to people with disabilities. On a poignant note, one of the ADAPT members from Texas passed away on Monday morning, not related to the actions themselves, but simply because she made the journey to Washington despite being in poor health. The woman's colleagues say her determination and commitment exemplify that of most members of ADAPT.
We who believe in freedom will not rest till we got the best.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Brendan Costello in Washington.
With the war in Iraq leaving close to 2,000 U.S. troops dead, military recruitment goals around the nation are falling short. President Bush's No Child Left Behind Act has a unique clause that is helping military recruiters in their efforts around the nation. The law requires all secondary schools to provide a list of every student's name, telephone number, and address. To protest the military's involvement in the country's education system, the San Diego Counseling Project visits Southern California schools to inform young people of their rights. Miles Ashdown has more from Mira Mesa High School.
Good morning. How are you today? Take a leaflet. Look it over. Stay out of the war. Got to bring our troops home, back to San Diego, where they deserve to be.
The handful of activists are not allowed onto school property, so they're stuck handing out leaflets to students who happen to pass by. Retired teacher Ron Sanders says the military should be completely separate from the schools.
I think they should be out here on the sidewalk where we are. So
I don't think they should be on the campus at all.
Much of the group's objection has to do with the war in Iraq. Again, Ron Sanders.
I'm not entirely a pacifist, but I think they shouldn't be on here recruiting for George Bush's illegal invasion of Iraq. And now we're, you know, paying for it with the lives of our innocent men and women in the military. And, you know, some of these kids will be out there someday. And I want to stop that.
Hey, I noticed you dropped something. Would you like to have it back? It's really good reading material. It could save someone's life, maybe even your own. Thanks a lot. Look it over.
Most of the students who took the anti-military recruitment brochure said nothing. A few threw it on the ground just a few feet away. Others praised the activists. One young man, Sang, said he's considered joining the military so he can protect people.
It's nice to have a military get involved with the school. Know that we're safe.
Philip was indifferent about the military being in the school.
They don't talk to me, so.
Junior Joshua Varon walked up to the leafleters and asked them a question.
Why are you guys passing out anti-recruitment?
Just so the kids are aware that they can opt out of automatically being having their information given to the military. A lot of kids don't know this.
Okay, I'm just curious. I've already joined, actually.
Oh, okay.
Why'd you join?
To serve my country and because I think that the Marine Corps will actually make me a better person.
Are you concerned about serving in Iraq?
No, not really. I mean, because of the job that I've been assigned to electronics maintenance, I think it's relatively safe.
Varon reports to duty on June 26th next year and plans to serve for a full 20 years. Laura Welts, a landscaper and occasional peace volunteer, said she hopes the leafleting will help dissuade other students.
It really breaks my heart to think of these kids participating in this very illegal, very immoral war because they're looking for a job or, you know, I just want the kids to know that they don't have to be on this list. They don't have to be harassed by the military recruiters. And I would really like to starve this war by not supplying it with any more troops.
Inside the school, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Ritter heads up the school's Air Force JROTC, a program he says helps students become better citizens for America.
And whether or not they go in the military, that's a personal decision that they make.
Ritter says some activists have the wrong idea.
They focus on the soldiers or they focus on the military as being to blame or being the people responsible for going to Iraq or going to Vietnam.
He says the military doesn't have an independent will.
If you have a beef with the way the military is being used, it would be with the people in Washington. Having a strong military doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go out and be an imperialist. It just means that you have it, but the politicians use it.
Want to end the war, bring the troops home, and keep you out of the situation.
Back outside, another veteran, Dave Patterson, believes this is the right approach, but said he was disheartened that he had to come to the school at all.
I just really am sickened by what this government's doing.
In San Diego, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
Holocaust survivor and Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal has died at the age of 96 today in Vienna. Wiesenthal endured life in a Nazi death camp along with family members, over 80 of which died in the camp. Wiesenthal then dedicated his life to representing millions of victims and brought over 1,000 Nazi war criminals to justice. Rabbi Marvin Heyer of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles said about Wiesenthal today that, quote, when the Holocaust ended in 1945 and the whole world went home to forget, he alone remained behind to remember, unquote. Again, Simon Wiesenthal passed today at the age of 96 in Vienna.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.